My name is Victor Bremsen. I am a co-founder in an organization called For the Grandchildren, and it is my pleasure to be the first person to welcome you here tonight. We're in for a very special evening. For the Grandchildren has three simple beliefs. You see them on the handout we gave you on the way in. We believe that everything is at stake. What we do right now, individually and in community, will determine our future. And we have a chance to live the most meaningful lives people have ever lived. Why do we say this? Have you noticed? Have you been reading the paper lately? The price of food and gasoline are going up all over the planet. Right now, we're experiencing rice shortages. Some people are referring to this moment as a perfect storm. The amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is increasing. The glaciers are melting. Our costly and destructive war continues to drag us down while our infrastructure falls apart. Healthcare costs continue to grow exponentially, and presidential politics are becoming more and more negative and more irrational. And last week, tens of thousands of people came together in Seattle to learn about compassion. The Washington State legislature just approved a bill that requires Washington State to adopt responsible limits on global warming pollution and became the first state in the country to make workforce training for good green jobs a key feature of its climate policy. Seattle City Council President Richard Conlin just proposed a local food action initiative which offers goals as lofty as they are sweeping: racial and social justice, environmental sustainability, improved public health, economic development, and more, including a zero waste policy. Small groups are forming up all through the bioregion for the purpose of coming up with big solutions for our problems by using tools such as whole systems design, action-based programs, all tied to compassionate community building. And people are finally understanding that our politics are corrupted and that we truly need to become the leaders that we are waiting for. And finally, in the first time in history of this country, for better or worse, we have a woman and an African American running for the highest office. So, why is this an amazing time to be alive? I'd like to welcome you tonight to the Great Turning. And first, one of our co-sponsors of the evening is Seattle Unity Church, and I'd like to introduce Richard Levy to give you a welcome from them.
Welcome to Seattle Unity Church, where the mind of the Buddha touches the heart of the living Christ, where the present moment is where the energy and the juice is, and when the heart opens up in the present moment, there's nothing we cannot and will not do. We are a welcoming spiritual community in the heart of Seattle, dedicated to celebrating, inspiring, and deepening our individual and collective spiritual journeys. We're so honored to have the likes of these two enormous beings on our planet right now, and the planet is ready to hear what they have to say. As we move from where we have been, and we see where it is and where it's taking us, to where we need to go and grow, we need resources. And we have those resources here. Joanna and David will be speaking about them tonight. We have had at this church an opportunity to be part of this great turning. Last week there were 1,000 adults and children practicing on our stage for the choir to sing of compassion and kindness for the Dalai Lama. We were so honored to have that happening. Sunday night, we had a Seder by this beautiful, beautiful man. That Sunday, I spoke about Moses and being led into the Promised Land. Here is the time for us to practice what we've been talking about for all these years, to move from where we've been to where we know we all want to go. And it starts by being present right here and now. And your presence here says yes. We have just recently redone our mission statement to be more involved with not just the spiritual principles, but putting our feet and our hands and our hearts into action in the world. And it's because of people like Victor that we've made this change. He wouldn't ease up. He said, "This is my church, and you will have a statement like this, or I won't come here anymore." Because it's too important. We just don't want to talk about it and internalize it. We need to now realize it in our actions. So this is actually part of what he helped us see. Our mission is to provide supportive, relevant programs for young people and adults which spiritually fulfill, environmentally sustain, and socially impact our human presence on planet Earth. Yes? Right here and right now. And so tonight we honor the truth of all traditions, and we manifest our beliefs by practicing loving kindness and forgiveness in our everyday lives, creating a positive future for our community and our planet. We are honored to have you all here, co-creating and participating in nothing less than the transformation of planet Earth. Thank you for saying yes.
Thank you, Richard. I'd like to thank our other sponsors tonight, including Yes Magazine, the Interra Project, the Heritage Foundation, Rites of Passage, IONS, many other organizations helped to make this night possible. And most importantly for me personally, and for many of you in the audience that I recognize your faces, the Pachamama Alliance Awakening the Dreamers Symposium organization was the group that first visualized this evening here tonight. All of these groups will have tables in the narthex afterwards, and we invite you to find out more about them. After the event, the authors will be signing books downstairs in the social halls where cookies and juice will be served. So we invite you to come downstairs afterwards, buy a book, get it signed, or just have some cookies and more conversation. Before introducing David and Joanna, we'd like to do just a few short things. The first thing is we'd like to do, I'm going to tell you three of them in a row. We will show you a short video. Secondly, we'd like you just to sit quietly and hear what the video said. And the third is we're going to ask you to pair up with somebody near you, hopefully somebody you don't know, and ask a question. And we'll have the question up on the board here, but I'll read it to you now. What is the most important question for our species at this moment of time? And the video that we're going to show you was a winner in the U at 50 challenge created by AARP. The contest launched in August of 2007 on YouTube gave people between the ages of 18 and 30 the chance to submit short videos on the subject of what they expect their lives to be like at age 50. The goal of the U at 50 challenge was to encourage intergenerational dialogue, enabling young people to speak their minds. Unfortunately, the quality of the video is a little bit poor, but the woman's voice that you will hear says every word that is scrolling before you. And the idea that I'm going to share with you, especially those in the back, will be halfway through the video, she will start repeating, she will start reversing the order of what she said. And what the message comes down to is the choice that we all have. So, Rich, do we have sound? Good.
I am part of a lost generation, and I refuse to believe that I can change the world. I realize this may be a shock, but happiness comes from within is a lie, and money will make me happy. So in 30 years, I will tell my children they are not the most important thing in my life. My employer will know that I have my priorities straight because work is more important than family. I tell you this. Once upon a time, families stayed together. But this will not be true in my era. This is a quick fix society. Experts tell me 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. I do not concede that I will live in a country of my own making. In the future, environmental destruction will be the norm. No longer can it be said that my peers and I care about this earth. It will be evident that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It is foolish to presume that there is hope. And all of this will come true unless we choose to reverse it. There is hope. It is foolish to presume that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It will be evident that my peers and I care about this earth. No longer can it be said that environmental destruction will be the norm. In the future, I will live in a country of my own making. I do not concede that 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. Experts tell me this is a quick fix society, but this will not be true in my era. Families stayed together once upon a time. I tell you this, family is more important than work. I have my priorities straight because my employer will know that they are not the most important thing in my life. So in 30 years, I will tell my children, money will make me happy is a lie, and true happiness comes from within. I realize this may be a shock, but I can change the world, and I refuse to believe that I am part of a lost generation.
David Corton, PhD, lives locally with his wife, Fran Corton. They've spent a lifetime working together to raise consciousness on this planet. Fran Corton is the publisher of Yes Magazine, and David frequently writes articles for Yes and other major publications. He writes and speaks on the danger of corporate consolidation of power, a trend that he refers to as empire. His books have included When Corporations Rule the World and his newest book, The Great Churning, From Empire to Earth Community. He talks about how we got into our current situation and what it will take to get us out of it. I met David several years ago and worked closely with him in helping to create the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. I consider him to be one of the important teachers of this generation.
Amen.
Eco-philosopher Joanna Macy is a scholar of Buddhism, general systems theory, and deep ecology. A respected voice in movements for peace, justice, and ecology, she interweaves her scholarship with four decades of activism. You'll often find her out on the picket line. She has created a groundbreaking theoretical framework for personal and social change, as well as a powerful workshop methodology for its application. I first met Joanna while spending a week with her on a Great Turning seminar at the University of Creation Spirituality. In that seminar, she taught us that whether we knew it or not, we were all part of the Great Turning. We all had our part to play. She is a teacher of experiential processes, and the Awakening the Dreamer Symposium offers several of her exercises within the symposium. To my knowledge, Joanna coined the phrase, the Great Turning, and David has written eloquently about it. The inspiration for this evening came from the fact that these two elders have taught so much about this topic. Why not put them together in a conversation and see what their thinking is today? And the conversation, first off, welcome. The conversation is going to work like this. I'm going to ask the two of them a couple of questions to get the conversation going. Afterwards, they will begin to ask each other questions. As a moderator, I may choose to throw in some questions myself as the evening goes on. So, David and Joanna, what we would like you to ask first is the question that the audience just spoke to, and we'd like you to take as much time as you'd like to answer this question. What is the most important question for our species at this moment of time? And I understand, David, that you'd like to speak first.
Okay. Thank you, Victor. It's such a privilege to be here with this amazing group in this splendid facility and a place that so characterizes the spirit of the work that in which we're engaged. You know, many of us have been working for decades on the need for deep transformational change of human societies. Joanna had quite an impact on my thinking, and she participated in a group of in a series of retreats that we did around Yes Magazine for progressive leaders from around the country to explore the nature of our time and the deeper nature of the work that we needed to join together to do. And Joanna was a very active participant in that, and she brought us to this terminology of the Great Turning, and helped us place it in a deeply spiritual context and connecting together the spiritual and the institutional. And when I was writing the book that became The Great Turning, but I was very focused on this, framing the transition in terms of the transition from a dominator system of organizing human societies we call empire, to a partnership system, a more egalitarian system that we call Earth Community. When the book came together, it just seemed like the perfect title was The Great Turning. But I thought of that as Joanna's term. And my publisher said, oh, that's the title you've got to use. I said, I couldn't possibly use it without checking with Joanna. So I called Joanna, and she said, I'd be delighted to have you use it because that term should belong to the species, to the planet, not to any particular person. And the more people use it as their own term, the better. So that's part of our connection. I have become increasingly conscious that in the work I'm doing now, my most important teachers have often been women. So thank God for the women's movement and the unleashing of the feminine. And it's a very special privilege to be in this church. I would like to have more contact with the Unity Church because what I do know about it is a faith community engaged in true spiritual inquiry. And that is one of the important missions of our time. We must dig deeper into our understanding of ourselves, our world, our relationship to creation, drawing on all the sources of knowledge that are available to us, including all of our religious traditions and our scientific traditions. And it's my understanding that that is what this church is about. And I want to honor you for that. So, to the question. What is the most important question we humans need to be asking ourselves right now? I've been giving a lot of thought recently as we're thinking about some media strategies to reach out with the Great Turning message more widely. And I've been thinking about what is the framing question that might engage a national conversation? And this is what I've come to. Why is there such an enormous gap between the world most people want and the world we have? Now, you'll note a premise in there that, in fact, we want the same thing, which is a little daring in this world in which we seem to be so deeply divided on so many different dimensions. But I had quite an extraordinary experience in 1992 when I participated in the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. I participated not in the official meetings, but in the civil society meetings over in the park near the beach. And that brought together some 15,000 people from all around the world representing virtually every nationality, race, religion, class. I mean, I'm quite certain that at no previous time in human history had there been a group of this size and this diversity. Now, since then, there have been many much larger with the social summits, but this was really the first of that encounter. And we were engaged in conversations about what is the world that we want to commit ourselves to create together. And it was a stunning insight when I realized that for all our differences, we all really wanted the same thing. Put very simply, it's a world of healthy, happy children. Strong and healthy families, strong, healthy communities, and a healthy, beautiful, natural environment. Now, isn't that simple? So basic. And if we all want it,
Why does it seem to be so hard to get it? But that, of course, gets into a very interesting conversation. And that is the beginning of the conversation about what we need to change. And there's a way I summarize the nature of our current situation as follows. This is where we depart from the world we want. First of all, we are, of course, destroying the planet. That's basically a question of overconsumption. As a species, we are consuming faster than the planet will tolerate. So, we have to roll back our consumption. By some accounts, as much as 80%. You know, that's all together. Second element of this crisis is extreme inequality. That's the other piece of the context within which we have to deal with this rollback. I'll not go into the details. I'm sure you know the extent of the extraordinary gap between the richest and the poorest among us. And that, of course, is the foundation of the social breakdown, the terrorism, crime, and all of the social stresses that we experience at all levels. So then what's the third element? The third element is we are governed by institutions that are by design devoted to increasing inequality, in part through increasing our total consumption. So there you have a three-part problem: overconsumption, extreme inequality, and a system of governing institutions designed to increase both of those things that are presently destroying us. So we have a bit of a problem. It's good to laugh about it because we get pretty wet with the tears. But think of this as the enormous creative challenge before us and the opportunity to engage in the deep reexamination of what it means to be human, of what our place is in the cosmos, of whether it really makes a difference whether we survive as a species or whether we expire by our own hand. It is a time of great awakening as well as a great turning. And at the heart of our problem are the stories that run in a constant loop in our heads, telling us that we are by nature a flawed species, that we are inherently violent, greedy, individualistic. And therefore, any thought of creating a world at peace and cooperation is naive, unreal, and impossible. Victor, I absolutely loved that video that you showed us. I've got to get that. That's going to go on my website, and it's got to be part of every one of our discussions. It so beautifully expresses those stories and then flips it around. It is a work of genius. I've never seen it before. Anyhow, changing the stories that frame the culture is a work that we can all engage in. That's part of what's so wonderful about it. We begin to change those stories, we begin to change the national conversation, and that's very much what we need to be doing. Cecile Andrews, who lives here in Seattle, I don't know if Cecile's in the audience, works on voluntary simplicity circles, among other things. When I was talking about this issue of stories, Cecile shared with me her insight, first of all, into the women's movement. She said, you know how the women's movement really gained traction and got such power? She said it was through conversations in women's living rooms. You know, at the time they were getting together, the prevailing cultural story was that the path to a woman's happiness, you know it, find the right man, marry him, and spend your life in his service. Does that work for any of you out here? And of course, when women got together in their living rooms, before they got together, they assumed if that story didn't work for them, it was their fault. There was something wrong with them. Fix yourself. When they shared their stories, they suddenly realized, it's not me, it's the story. And so they began to mobilize to change the story. Now, we've seen the same thing in the environmental movement and the civil rights movement. And, of course, in the voluntary simplicity movement, very straightforward, we're told constantly that happiness is found through buying things, consuming. You get together, you begin to find out what brings us. We share our stories about what brings us real happiness. And, of course, it is more about relationships, family, community, love. So we've got to get to work on changing the stories. And the deepest of the stories that we need to be changing and exploring are the stories, our meaning stories. The stories by which we define who we are as humans, what our place is in the universe. And you might think of a series of questions that I would hope might become the conversation of every institution or our faith communities. Does creation have any purpose or meaning? Does life have any purpose or meaning? Does our existence as humans have any purpose or meaning? Does our survival as a species actually make any difference to anything? And there are an awful lot of stories circulating out there that suggest that maybe there isn't any real meaning. But those are also false stories, which we'll talk more about later, I'm sure. Joanna.
Thank you. Well, before I give my question, I want to say a few things, too. I'm very moved by your introduction, Vic. The way Vic stood up here and just presented to us, that was an act of such respect to encapsulate in such a punchy fashion some of the ghastly obscenities of our time, and just respect us enough to, in this beautiful place, to remind us, because we need to realize that we can open our eyes and our hearts and our minds to what is happening to our world. And so to just level that, to set that context, as well, of course, as then to talk about the amazing things that are happening on the grassroots level, such as you called forth. And I want to thank you for bringing us together under this banner. And I just have to say, David, and to all of you, that David Corton, to me, is an example of so much courage and originality when he, with his economic background, his in mainstream economics, impeccable credentials, came out when he came out with "When Corporations Rule the World." This instantly served both Fran Macy and we both have a spouse named Fran, Fran Court and Fran Macy, and my husband and I immediately were using your work in our workshops and trainings and intensives. And to see that someone, I mean, it was such, it convicts so much about the human spirit that someone with your training could see the light and have the wherewithal, the gumption and the facts and the analysis to be able to show that indeed this corporate globalized system is not reformable. Now that takes, there are a lot of people I work with who wouldn't agree with that, who want to say, well, we just figure and we'll have, but that was very, very refreshing and very important to me. And then when you followed it with a life after capitalism and the post-corporate world, this was and again, so clearly defined. This was very helpful to me in seeing how thorough and recognizing what I already knew in my body and in my spiritual inklings, glimpses of the enormity of this time, is that our political economy is based on a self-destructive system. And indeed, this man used the term suicide economy. You did.
I did.
And that we were... So this was very important to realize, as I shared in my workshops and in my life, that we don't have to all gird up and put on our armor and rush out to destroy this political economic system. It's doing it very well itself. It's self-destructive. Now, it's running out of control, but it's becoming more evident every day that it's a runaway system, accelerating exponentially its own demise. And it's just, the question is, how quickly can we move in our collaborative work and in our inspired glimpses of what is possible, and indeed the questions we ask to help it make a soft landing, or what's, I like, managed collapse, so that there's a lot left for us, some left for those who come after us. And to be sitting here with this banner behind us, with this organization committed to coming generations, and for me, that future is not, I'm lucky enough to have biological grandchildren, but I'm thinking, as you are too, whether you have your own children, grandchildren or not, these are the future generations that are at stake here. When you say everything at stake, that's they. And this recognition of them has become central in my life and work. So my question then is, that comes to me, is can we allow the future generations to become real to us? And if we, as we do, can we allow them hear what they would say to us? Because if we let that in, if we can hear what they'd say to us, then that would cut through so many of the niggly-piggly little discussions about we have, what we do, it would just... And as we do, if we can let them in, that presence, then that would mean also that we could open ourselves, our heart, minds to our own age. And this is part of the great turning too. That we are seeing the world and the cosmos with new eyes, actually very ancient eyes. The indigenous ones saw it this way too. That the life that is in us, that has brought us here, that is breathing us this very moment in this sanctuary, goes back and back and back through all our ancestors of all the species, all the life forms that we remembered in our mother's womb. Back, back to the first splitting and spinning of the stars. And we know that every particle and every atom and every molecule and every cell of our body goes back to those galaxies forming. So can we open up to the immensity of the life that is within us? Because I feel if we would, we even wouldn't put up with this. Oh, watch my language. We wouldn't put up with it. And that we would feel the majesty of the life, this opportunity, this moment now that is entrusted to us. What we can choose, not just for our own wonderful role as social visionaries, healers, NGO leaders, but for life. And to hear that, this is what is to me so exciting about the great turning. And I hope that in our discussion, maybe I'll just start us that way too. I'm finding that when... with, as you do with this question, and as I do with this question of mine, can we let the future ones be real to us? Can we let them approach by the power of our imagination? Can we believe, as one of my teachers, Sister Rosalie Bertel, she's an expert radiologist and witness in many trials of anti-nuclear activists, and she says, every being who will ever live on Earth is here now. Where? In your ovaries and in your gonads and in your DNA. They're present. And the decisions that we make, often pressured by business efficiency, goals, profits, bureaucratic administration, those hurried decisions will determine whether these future ones, up to scores, hundreds of generations into the future, will be born sound of mind and body. And that's because in this moment that we are sharing now, living a life, we, our karma extends into geological time spans. By karma, I mean the consequences of our actions. Because of what we have done to the ecosystems and because of the kinds of contaminants we have fabricated and in huge amounts released into the biosphere or keep in very faulty containments. My preoccupation with radioactive materials has been very important for helping me realize that the how close the future ones are. And in the workshops, those of you who've worked with me, and I know that Victor said he has taken this process into the Pachamama work, where we, and we'll do some this weekend, those of you in the workshop, where we allow ourselves to experience the future ones in us and speak for them and listen to them, so that this broadens our time span, the time frame of our lives, which is so important because, as David talks about the pathology of the corporate system, part of it is this acceleration, this tiny quick fix, short-term thinking. You have to grow the profits and your market share within this quarter compared to the next quarter. Last quarter, the same quarter a year ago, and that growth rate has to accelerate or you think you're stagnating. And this is a recipe for disaster. And it is part of what we're feeling in our own lives, I think, of this acceleration of time. Things are really having to move so fast and that has roots in our system. So to move and open our, to a broader frame of time, to, as this banner says, to be present to the future, to allow the future ones into the present moment. And this really begins to change everything from that linear speeding one-way arrow that has been so endemic to the mainstream thinking of our culture. So, having said that, David, I want to say, this question of time, have you found that in thinking about the stories, your wonderful work, but seeing how we change the story. Now, this is epical work. This takes time. You can't change a story overnight. You can't change a story by the next balance sheet of that quarter. This is big cultural stirring. Stories about our what's prosperity, what's meaning, what's safety, what's security. What have you found happening to your own sense of time?
Wow. Certainly in my work, there has been an expansion of the time frame. I guess maybe partly out of my business school training. Of course, back when I went through business school, it wasn't quite such short-term thinking. That's been increasingly accelerated in the past few decades. But certainly in the move from when corporations rule the world to the great turning, you know, the corporate framework is at best goes back 400 years, although most of, you know, what we focused on had been post-World War II. But you put it in the deeper framework of the turning, and you're going back to the it really puts me back to the beginning of the cosmos and the whole story. I mean, the immediate story of empire goes back 5,000 years, but that builds on the story of the earlier human experience, which builds much further back. And I think, you know, I think that recovering that time frame is absolutely essential. I think as you were, you know, as you were speaking about kind of rediscovering our connection to eternity and to evolution, to the whole process of creation, I think that's absolutely foundational. And I'm very struck by, you know, what we know of most indigenous peoples, of course, had that deep sense of connection to their ancestors as well as to future generations and to their place on earth. And I think that's one of the profound things that's happening. You know, in terms of a lot of these stories about the economic growth story and so forth, I mean, a lot of people get that instantly. We haven't certainly changed the story and the culture because the corporate media maintain it. But most of these stories about economic growth, equity, the crazy stories of security that we can all be more secure if we bomb ourselves into oblivion. You know, people get it pretty quickly that that's nonsense, partly because, you know, most of the things I write about, as you quite correctly noted, were things that most people know already. I mean, all this stuff about corporate power and corporate greed and mismanagement, that was not new to anybody. I just said it. And that gives a little credibility because I've got these credentials. So then other people can say it. But the deeper thing of recovering our connection to Earth, that goes much deeper. And I'm very struck by some of the things that I see happening. I suspect you're much closer to this than I am. But I've started conversations with people that are working on the issues of eldering and changing our whole story of what aging is about and the role of the elders. And of course, Empire wants us elders to go away and play golf or sit on the beach or something because they don't want that spiritual insight or wisdom that we gain over our years to contaminate the rest of the society. So part of our work is to reclaim elderhood and the role of the elder, that this actually is should be our most exciting and productive time of life, not a time sitting around waiting to die. But then I've also been talking with youth leaders who are talking about the energizing of the young people as the leading edge, the pioneers of the great turning and bringing forth a new civilization. Then I was very struck by the speed with which some of these groups started coming together and saying, you know, it's intergenerational. It's about restoring rites of passage, and began to really recognize that it's about changing our whole sense of our relationships to each other, rebuilding community, and in relation to the continuity of life and the continuity of generations and the roles that we pass through as we move through life, but also within a deep sense spiritual connection to Earth. And I sense that this rebirth is coming forth very quickly. What are you? Are you saying that?
Oh, yeah. I actually think that this is an almost dizzying rate of speed, that there is both a cognitive, perceptual, and spiritual change in seeing our interconnectedness. And I can't argue this to people, but I just want to take them along and listen to some of you guys and come to the you know, the seminars that we listen to and the workshops that we see and the way people talk. I just came back from Findhorn Foundation in Scotland where there was their big Easter conference was on climate change and peak oil. Mm-hmm. Our friend Richard Heinberg was there,
yes,
as well as people who were talking about climate change per se. And there was a lot of, you know, straight talk. And there was but so much vigor from grassroots, sort of the version over there of what we're finding here in our post-carbon networks and localized, living localized economies. Mm-hmm. They have their transition towns and transition villages where people are coming together. It's very exhilarating, actually.
You know, I think one of the keys that that we're seeing here is the leadership coming up from the bottom, including from localities, and particularly from the cities and the states, way, way ahead of our national
government. Yeah, and people are deciding not to wait until the politicians get it right. That they've given up on that. Not given up, but necessarily, but acting.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I could just mention from that to help us, I was very surprised that at a conference that was devoted to so much information and also a lot of information that was kind of, you know, apocalyptic in nature about what's going on with the global warming and with the how the effects of peak oil, which is just in the last week since I've been home, just, you know, and just what has been Lester Brown and Richard Heinberg and as well as many others have predicted when that happens with the food shortages and the hunger and the food scarcity. I was thinking as I was sitting there that I just would like to take a moment to remember all our brothers and sisters around the world who are hungry. At the moment, Haiti, you've probably been reading about it, Ethiopia, Thailand, all over Africa. You know, you can see the future ones in them. It's like the future's there too. The way to fear it is there. So what I was surprised at what they did. They asked me to come and do a workshop at the beginning of this conference. And we did, as many of you know, in the work that we do and the work that reconnects, we ground in gratitude for being alive, the immensity of the life that is in us. I keep using that phrase because there was a song I've just been listening from St. Francis about una immensa vita is in us, if we could recognize it. And to be grateful for the dimensions of the story. So we ground in that. And then we honored the pain. We honor our pain for the world. And we just did that there with 250 people. And it was amazing. We created a ritual with bowls of tears and the great open space around which there were the banks of seats. And people would come down in the half light with this beautiful music or this lament going, and they would come to the bowls of tears. These were Gaia's tears. And they would kneel by them and just spontaneously as they wanted to and say, these are my tears. My tears are for the hunger in Haiti. My tears are for the melting of the glaciers. These my tears. And then we owned that so that we would be sure to know as we took them out and poured the tears back into the earth. We said, we promise that we will know that the tears we shed are not just our private sensitivity or anything. We all know that they're Gaia's tears, that they bring us into solidarity. So this ceasing to be afraid of the pain we carry and the grief we carry and the outrage we carry, to own that and see that it is even actually an expression of our love for life. It's an expression of our passion for justice. And to own that and let that open us, release our energy from efforts to try to cover it up and look like a successful, ever-smiling person. And to know that we, and here, and then we went on to do a lot of deep time work and so forth. So I wanted to, in connection with that, David, I want to acknowledge how I have taken and run with your concept of the great unraveling.
Whoa.
in the book, as you may know, David lays out the great turning as the adventure of our time, the necessary one, and in its from empire to earth community, the promise of it. But he also says that if we don't make that, then it's the great unraveling. And actually, as I've fallen into the habit of saying, they're both happening at the same time. Under the pressure of the industrial growth society and the corporate system, these biological and ecological systems, us, this life is unraveling. And so there's both going on, the great turning, shooting up with sprouts, incredible creativity and originality and power and diversity, and then the unraveling.
You know, I want to pick up on some of this. One of the things that's very important about what you're saying about the crisis going on over there in other countries, you know, often hear people say, well, it's going to have to get a lot worse before it gets our attention. And, of course, what those people are saying, it has to get worse for us. You know, it's already gotten as bad as it can get for a whole lot of people in the world. Now, this comes down to a very important issue of our individual maturity. Because part of the process of a maturing consciousness and a maturing psyche is an increasing capacity to identify with the condition of others. The capacity to experience compassion and to feel that pain. So what you're leading through people through of feeling that pain is very important. Not just for our cleansing, but for really engaging this reality that it is already intolerably bad for a great many people, and our time just hasn't quite come. One could say that by the time our time comes, at least the time of those of us most privileged, it will be too late. The social and environmental systems will have unraveled, and that is part of our challenge of creating this deeper sense of connection and empathy. But I want to mention something here that to me gives evidence that there is some larger plan or intelligence at work, and that creation wants us to succeed. I mean, I think creation's sending us a message. You know, Mr. Bush gives a lot of indication that he believes he was sent by God. And I share that belief. I think indeed he was. It just wasn't for the purpose that he thought. But it has been an amazing wake-up call. So that's one side that creation's on our side. But the deeper thing, and it's part of why I'm so intrigued with this dominator system framing and getting into the context of empire. Because once you understand that organizational frame of empire, you realize that once you've created a system with a very few people on the top and most people on the bottom, it creates a very clear dynamic of competition and violence. Because being on the bottom
means total exclusion. You know, throughout much of history, it's meant total subjugation, slavery, and exclusion. And it hasn't changed all that much, unfortunately. The competition for the few places at the top becomes extremely intense. And we've seen that play out through history in its different forms, from the city-states of the ancient empires to then the nation-states and now our corporations and global financial institutions. Now, once that dynamic of competition is in place, it becomes very difficult to break out of. You know, either you dominate your neighbor or your neighbor dominates you. So it's kill or be killed, rule or be ruled.
Win-lose.
Win-lose. And, you know, you can become a monk or a sage or something and try to escape into some mountain retreat, but it's very difficult to bring change within the system. Now, we're seeing the end game of that play out now. So what's the hopeful sign? It is the fact that in the nearest instant of time and within the lifetimes of pretty much every person in this room, we have developed the communications capability, both in our transportation, but particularly in the internet and our electronic communications capabilities, for the very first time for ordinary people all around the world to engage in a conversation of the whole and beginning to create the capacity to function with a species intelligence. This is the only way we can break out of this pattern. And the fact that it has happened at exactly the precise moment at which we face the imperative to use that intelligence to fundamentally change our relationships with one another and with Earth, it just seems like it's got to be more than pure coincidence. A sign that creation is on our side and a reason for hope. You know, I would like to hear your thoughts on the question of purpose. What is the purpose of creation? What is our human purpose? Why are we here? Would it make any difference if we went away?
Well, what if the hokey pokey is what it's all about? Well, you know, you've seen that bumper sticker. And actually, an acquaintance of mine, just the other day, gave me the etymology of that. And that hocus pocus stems from the time of the Reformation when people were making fun of the priest raising the host in the Eucharist, and it's in a whole corpus or something. Yeah. So that to make fun of that, they'd say, well, we don't believe in that hocus pocus. See? So, but this is my body. This is my body. So, what it's all about could be recognizing that this is our body, this earth. That when we burn down the Amazon, we're burning our lungs. When we let mercury flow in, dioxin flow into our streams, it's flowing into our veins. And as a student and scholar of religion, I've been fascinated by the speed of which this awareness of our total interpenetration, dependence on interconnectedness in the living body of Earth. When I was in majoring in religion, about a century or two ago, it was mid-20th century, there wasn't a word about this. Then when I went back a quarter century later in my 40s to do graduate work in religion.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a word about this in, you know, major academic. It just goes right into it, not just up here in your thinking organ or in your feeling organ, but right down to your base chakra. Whoa, we are alive with life. We're coming alive again into such a larger dimension that I feel that, and I call this forth, I expect that, and I see it in political dissent and resistance, which we need. You know that.
I do.
I mean, we have, I was just talking to Michelle downstairs when I hadn't seen her since the year 2000, and I said, would you believe what's happened? You know, we've had the coup of January 1, and then we've had 9/11, and then even then we couldn't have imagined how the Constitution has been shredded. And that we've lost habeas corpus. And that I could walk out of here and be detained for the rest of my days without trial. And that would be. And that we have the Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. So what I'm saying is not to... Well, it's worth saying, isn't it? Anyway. that this question of this experience, really, of feeling the... vitality and sacredness of Earth as something that is inside us, not just some idea about our environment, changes everything and empowers us. This is about power for the great dream. And so it can empower us to speak out and act for the devastation of our freedoms that's going on. It's giving us the nerve and the endurance to do what's going to have to be done to retrieve the capacity to honor each other and steer this country and our choices that we make, our self-governance around the planet.
You know, in terms of interactivity, one of the stunning insights that deeply influenced my thinking came out of contact with a microbiologist, Dr. Maewon Ho, an amazing, very petite Asian lady.
Can I just interject that the way you dedicated your book to her,
yeah,
as well as to Elizabeth Satouris,
mm-hmm,
moved me very much, that you allowed these female scientists to take them so seriously and to realign your thinking.
Well,
praise be.
Women have had a lot of impact on my life. Thank you. Dr. Maewon Ho, in my view, is on one of the women that works on the cutting edge of biology, and she talks about how we've, so much of biology has completely missed the real nature of life, because they study life by taking a living cell and grinding it up to study its chemical composition. She studies life to understand it on its own terms. And one of the insights comes from the way life manages energy. That every cell has a capacity to maintain embodied energy in an active state. And part of how this is done is through continuous recycling within the cell, but constant exchange among cells and also constant exchange among organs and among organisms. And part of what comes out of this is a realization that even in terms of basic physics of life, life cannot exist in isolation from other life. It can only exist in relation to other life. Now, another woman biologist, Lynn Margulis, done extraordinary work on the earliest evolution of life during the initial single cells. In one of her books, one of her descriptions of life is, life
is matter with the capacity to choose. And I think this connects back to your idea of every molecule that's with us now has existed from the beginning of creation. But it's evolving. And life is an expression of matter's capacity to choose. Now, also when we look at the science of entropy, the winding down of energy, what we see is life is a kind of counterforce. It ultimately adheres to those laws, but it is, in a sense, life is a constant struggle against entropy. And you can begin to think of that as a cooperative struggle against entropy, that none of us can do it alone. And that, to me, just, it tells a profound story about this interdependence. But it also, to me, is a deep source of meaning as one looks at the deeper nature of the growth, the development, the evolution of the cosmos and life. In terms of, Fran, my wife, and I have, a lot of our work in Asia and earlier work was based around social learning approaches to changing large-scale institutional systems. And we learned a lot about how you do that through learning, through conversation, through experimentation, testing, but learning, reflection, so that whole social systems learn together. And to me, that fits, that's basically the story of what the cosmos has been doing from the beginning of time, from totally diffuse matter to constantly winding up toward greater potential and possibility and ever higher levels of reflective consciousness. And that this is the purpose of creation, is exploring those potentials. And to me, this is why I believe there is real purpose and meaning to our existence as humans. That, every being in creation, every molecule is a contributor to that learning and that capacity building. And every organism is a contributor. And as you understand living systems, every organism has its distinctive place of contribution. Again, an insight from the woman biologist that the species that ultimately succeed and thrive over the longer term are not the most brutal and competitive. They are those that find their place of service to the whole. And this is the frame, I think, in which we need to think about ourselves as humans. I mean, one could say that we were evolution's worst mistake. In a way, we are creation's most extraordinary experiment with the power of choice, with reflective consciousness, which can be used either productively for the continued creative unfolding of the whole, or can be used, as we have been using it, to destroy the whole process.
Can I just interject?
Yeah, absolutely.
Struck me very much, looking both at systems and at some spiritual teachings, particularly the Buddhist.
Yeah.
And I wrote about this in my most recent book, which is out on the table, the new edition of World as Lover, World as Self. But that the from the perspective of living systems, what the self is, what you are, what I am, cannot be reduced to a permanent abiding entity, but it's reduced to an activity. So the system's view puts everything from noun into verb. You are a verb. Actually, as Buckminster Fuller said in a book I love, I seem to be a verb. And how that really, to explore how that changes, how your approach to change, or your approach to a problem, or your approach to the promise of the great turning, is that actually you are already, you are change. And then, both the systems perspective And this is very dramatic in the highly sophisticated psychology of the Buddha's teachings, is that it's the choice making is where you can locate what that most characteristic, essential verb is. What is most you about you is in your the choices that you make. And this is an extraordinary notion, actually, that can enliven and, yes, give a lot of charge, purpose, meaning mm-hmm. to what you're confronted with. So that I find it, I was writing about this in the piece that you were kind enough to print in, yes, in the current issue, about living with uncertainty, or is it, you know, great unraveling, great turning, and we don't know how things are going to, how can I stand it if I'm not sure, I have to be sure, I have to have hope, no, I don't have hope. Sort of, well, so what? It doesn't matter that much, because hopeful or hopeless is really, it's a passing feeling. It might have to do about who said nice things to you that morning, what you had for breakfast, or you had a good night's sleep. But within a period of this huge uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating me more and more, what uncertainty brings forward in us is that it shines a bright light on the power of your choice. And you can all take refuge in your capacity to choose. And you can free yourself from always having to be computing your chances of success or taking your pulse. Am I optimistic at the moment? You know, who cares? The thing is that to choose. And that's what you are. I mean, your attention or your choice making, as I said in that piece, so be sure to read Yes magazine, it's just the one thing you can count on. You can't count on how things are, you know, whether things are going to come up roses tomorrow, or whether we're going to be, you know, what's going to happen for us. But you can count on what your motivation is. And you can treasure it. The Buddhists call this your bodhicitta. You can blow on it. Be thankful that you can care and make the choices for it, as you have done.
Oh, beautiful. You know, I think related to that is the what I think of as a transition going on in science from classical Newtonian physics to quantum physics. From the idea that only matter, or the self, is real, to the idea that, well, maybe it's only relationships that are real. You know, I think this raises another deeper set of questions about choice. And the line between what we think of as matter and the line between and life. And how far down does choice making go in the system? Now, I know you've done some interesting writing about transcendence and immanence. One of the stunning insights that I got into the spiritual and to some of the conflicts in Christianity came at a gathering we had here in Seattle in 1999. It was just before the WTO demonstrations. And the Seattle and Washington Council of Churches had a conference on economic justice. And Marcus Borg was one of the main speakers. And I had the privilege of sharing the stage with him. But I was so struck by what I took to be his framing message. Tell me your image of God, and I'll tell you your politics. of course, what he's talking about is the choice between the image of God as the jealous patriarch out there, the transcendent God, versus the immanent spirit that expresses through all creation and all being. And the one creates a sense of separation of your God against my God. It's part of the empire structure, that whole empire mindset. Who is closer to God? Who is more pure? Who is more worthy? Who does God love the most? Which is obviously the people with wealth and power, right? I mean, you know, he makes all decisions, so that must be it. Versus the idea that we are all interconnected, we are all expressions of the same spirit, the same intelligence. Now, I was looking forward to asking you tonight about how you think about that immanence and transcendence.
This is like the story of my life. I mean, that's what was so wonderful about living when I've been living, you see, because I cover so much of the 20th century.
Well, it's really great to be so old when you still have some wits about you.
There's so much of the journey of that time. I was crazy about God. And I grew up in the church, and my grandfather was a preacher, and he was a pulpit-pounding preacher. Actually, what he shouted about, to be sure people knew, was that God loves you. That's all for sake. He loves you enough to give his only begotten son, et cetera, et cetera. However, so I was just loved the church. It was the only, in my nuclear family, it was the only place we could go and hear nice things being said. It's in New York City. I described that in my book, my memoir, Widening Circles, which is also out on the table.
So, I do want to tell you that there came a time, so I was so crazy about God and Jesus that I devoted myself to studying them. I was going to serve the church, and though living when I was living at that age, then didn't occur to be a minister, but I'd be a missionary.
Hmm.
However, as I studied the church fathers in college, I got so exasperated and fed up and bored that I just could hardly stand it. And this God that they were arguing about became a big, frowning, judgmental spy looking over my shoulder. And he, this is my just my experience of him. It was a him. And so that I had to make a rupture in my life that was very painful for me, as well as liberating. And I walked out into nothing. But I had to cut myself free from that judge.
Yeah.
And only later, and that grew up with you know, our years in the Peace Corps after I married and so on, I opened to what my body and my dreams and my passions had known all along, that this life, it's sweet, and this life is sacred, and that this has been a knowledge of most of my people, my planet people, for most of their history. And it was sort of, instead of a remote, static God, there was this presence that came, imminent, and she changes everything she touches. That just changes. And she is the face of all. She doesn't have jealous fits. She has strong things to say on occasion. But so she's shining through. I see the work of Satouris and of Dr. Ho and of David Corton. And if so many of you, this sense of the utter, irreducible sacredness of life itself. I think that, if we can open to that, it can save us. It can save life. So that is life's purpose, to dance. And I would just say about, this word struggle you used, yes, but it feels more, when I look at living systems, that it's more like a dance. Mm-hmm. And that I feel it particularly, and I find it so useful as we make our strategies for action and campaigns for the fair, sustainable society, that we realize that synergies happen in relationships as they interweave, and as you take a step, there are things that happen you could never predict. I mean, just take an oxygen atom, hydrogen, and you put it together. You have something that wasn't there before. Water. You have these emergent properties. That's one of the most exciting things to me, David, is the play of synergies and emergent properties. And that gives me it whets my appetite daily for what is happening in the Great Turning. That as people come together, and I bet you've seen this in your work with local living economies, that you couldn't have predicted what people concoct and find themselves doing on the local level.
No, absolutely. It is, I mean, that's the exciting part of the process of change. It is the process of emergence. But I think there is, I don't know, I'm not quite sure myself how to deal with the issue of struggle. I mean, obviously the resistance that you talk about is struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I also note that, you know, resistance alone is a losing strategy. That, of course, is what a lot of what YES is about, as we recognize that if we simply resist the injustices, excesses of the existing system, we lose in the end. And that, of course, is one of the great challenges of our time, is that this is the moment when we have to come forward and take the initiative, and we have to be coming forward with positive visions. And I think there are struggles in the positive visions. There are creative struggles. Because there is a downward force in the universe. The force of entropy is real.
And the things can unravel.
Yeah. And the, you know, the darker side of our human nature is real also. But our challenge is to, at this particular point in time, I believe, is to recognize the potentials of our nature. I think we're probably getting fairly close to the close, but I want to just bring in this question of what is our inherent nature as human beings? And I think we're coming to a deeper understanding. And it's one of those questions that we need to examine, because we certainly see lots of evidence in the world of the depth of our capacity for self-destruction. And of course, we are told in so much of our religious teaching, I guess not the more positive teaching of your father, but the ideas of original sin, or the ideas in evolution that progress comes only through competition and violence and survival of the most brutal, that is our nature and that is the path to progress. Now, that, of course, is one of the stories that runs through our head. And, you know, part of the moving ahead is to break out of that story, to recognize, you know, one of the things I encourage people to do is think about what is your own experience? Are most of your friends and family cruel and brutal and selfish, or are they basically caring, giving and loving? Are they cooperative? Do they get their greatest satisfaction from being of service? And of course, I think for most of us, you know, most of the people we know are pretty decent people. And of course, the people we most admire are the ones that have the highest expression of those capacities. I'd be interested in
you. Yeah, I would like to speak to your reference just now to the cruelty. I don't know, you didn't use the word cruelty, but you used destructiveness.
Yeah.
That we humans manifest.
Well, that we are capable of.
And that, well, and in our, we are preparing nuclear war. We've been doing that since 1945. We did it, and our capacity to destroy has been growing. The forms of suffering and death are weapons and the devastation and suffering that we have inflict on civilians in our with our weaponry, in our war making, with the forms of enforced interrogation, as we call it, and legitimization of torture, and what we have seen our country capable of, as has been revealed, a current book just out, JFK and the Unspeakable, as well as books about, also by a theologian, another one on what the evidence in 9/11 that points to things we don't like to think about ourselves. We don't like to think that humans are, and there's a strong current.
But is that all we're, is that all we're capable of?
No, just that. Okay. See, don't go there. Don't say if you acknowledge the this.
Well,
dark
I said
it doesn't mean it's the only thing. But what what's been in my mind recently, David, is that I've been using this term, the Great Turning, and I thought to myself, I mean, for years and years, but I thought to myself, is there a deeper current that I need to attend to? Is there a deeper meaning there? And it's in our spiritual traditions, in the Hebrew teshuva, in the Greek metanoia. It is a meaning of repentance. It's a turning around. It's a recognition. No, not that we're, you know, hopelessly evil, but that we've done some ghastly things. We've been capable of that. We've shown we've been capable of that. So I'm just exploring. I think that there's a depth to our capacity to respond to this time that needs to be enlisted so that we can see the full spectrum, so that we can see that there's blood on our hands. And I think that only when we see that there's blood on our hands can we, well, it's like a moral equivalent to the wounded healer. And we get off the kind of spiritual purity that has been encouraged by empire thinking, that we are mutually responsible for each other. We have hurt each other terribly. I'm wondering if there are not ceremonies that await the development for us where we can truly acknowledge, like they did in have been doing in the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, that have been one of the great moral triumphs of our age. Or this extraordinary, I wish I had every speech of the Prime Minister of Australia, where he stood up there on his hind legs and he said to the Aboriginal people, he said, we have mistreated you in the most egregious terms. And he said, we are deeply so, we are ashamed, we apologize. There is something, when I read his words, and then I think about the ancient teachings, I think that now I see, in a way I hadn't before, that must be part of the Great Turning.
This has been absolutely a wonderful conversation. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to take one or two questions from the audience.
Sure.
Would you? So this is unplanned, But it's been such a stimulating conversation. I'm wondering if someone in the audience would like to state a question. Would you come forward if you'd like to do it? We just have time for about two.
Oh, I want to thank you for opening the space to be able to talk about the things that are uncomfortable, to be able to speak that, because so much of what I seem to hear these days is, I just want to talk to the positive. Let's just focus on the positive. And I am grateful that you opened up that space. As I was listening to you tonight, what I was seeing is kind of the convergence of two tidal waves. One is the patriarchal context of commerce that's driving the things that are so painful. And the other is what might be called, what some call the cultural creatives, or I might call the increasingly conscious cultural co-creatives. But that whole part of us is bringing on a new possibility. And what my concern is the intersection of those two waves, of where they actually come together. And there's, sometimes we seem to think, okay, if we just do what's positive, everything will kind of work out. And I'm kind of concerned about what happens in the middle of those two tidal waves coming together. And there was as you were speaking, just toward, maybe I'll just leave it at that, if you could just speak to that.
Oh, well, they come together in each of us, I think. I mean, I see them as really more psychic or internal in the psychosphere. We all have been conditioned by top-down thinking, hierarchical thinking. We've all been conditioned to want to compete and want to control. And that's in us. Our education, our language feeds into that. Our fear does too. And when we're scared, we, you know, try to reach that certainty and that power, that club, that. And then equally, as I was testifying and as many of you here and what you celebrate here at Unity Church, is this arising of this resacralization of life itself that David has evoked so beautifully about the self-organizing of life and its purpose. So maybe we're the people, you know, some theologians have talked and named us people of the in-between time, that these encounter us. I think it's more a psychic and for us not to be afraid and for us to know that it's just how we choose. Every minute, it's just how we choose. Which are you going to choose? You can only choose for yourself. You can't make anybody else choose. But, oh, that capacity to choose is the most precious thing. And you've been given that. You can choose what you do with your mind. You can choose where you place it. Imagine being given that gift, and you have it.
I think the key here is recognizing that for all of the destructiveness of which we are capable, there is a higher aspect to our nature and a higher possibility for compassion, love, and for creating a world based on cooperation and mutual caring. And that much of what's happening in the Great Turning, and what it truly depends on, is the rate of awakening of that higher consciousness. And it's spreading individual by individual. What the outcome will be is very difficult to anticipate. I sometimes think of it as we are being tested by creation to determine whether we are a species worthy of survival, and to demonstrate our worthiness, it depends on awakening that capacity and bringing it forth and expressing it to find our place of service to the whole.
I heard a comedian recently talk about the fact that what our purpose was was that the earth needed plastic. So our purpose is now served.
Well, there's also a theory that we were needed to release all that carbon into the atmosphere. For some reason, I haven't determined yet.
Okay, so in the first part of your talk, I came up with four solutions, type solutions. So my first solution would be to create an effective recycle program, and then just to redistribute all the wealth. Okay, and then to be able to find a machine or some advance in science to get the greenhouse gases like CO2, which you guys make a big deal about, out of the air.
But what are we going to do with it?
To have an advance in the sciences to be able to get CO2 out of the air, because it comes from oil, and I'm sure you could be able to
get it out of the air.
Some advance in science. You don't believe that's possible? No? All right. And then a population control. So that would create a maximum limit on the number of resources one could use. And I don't know if you want to make this a partisan thing, but what I get from what liberals are all about is they're about setting limits on setting limits in general. So why wouldn't you do that with population? And it seems like if you were to set limits, this would create smaller corporations by nature, because they would have to specialize. So is that rational answers? Are those rational solutions to your whole issue of increase in profits and accelerated, I don't know.
I'm sorry, neither one of us are hearing clearly enough to be able to respond.
Eric, I think Eric has listed a group of possible solutions for the problems. And he's asking, are those rational solutions for where we are today?
Yeah.
Like population control. Is that a rational
solution? Population control, okay.
New technological discoveries. Advances in science. I think Eric is asking, can we expect solutions of these types to solve the problems that we're facing?
Yeah, responses of the kind of those that I was able to hear are essential. And that also the situation we're in and the dangers we face are not the change that we must make cannot be reduced to a technological fix. It has to be a vast perceptual shift in consciousness, but that shift in consciousness will then involve a lot of new responses that employ new technologies.
Yeah. I think the key point is that what you just emphasized, we're not going to get out of this mess with tweaking the system at the margins. And we're definitely not going to get out of it with technological fixes, although we've got to use technology that's available. The thing that's not part of the conversation that needs to be are the extraordinary opportunities to actually improve the quality of our lives as we decrease the quantity of air consumption. And, of course, I'm sure many of you here are part of the voluntary simplicity movement. And that's important to be conscious in our individual choices. But the other piece of it is being aware that I also don't think we can get where we need to go just through these individual choices, that we have got a society that is organized in a way that it makes it very difficult for us to live responsibly. If you start thinking about the distribution of per capita shares. And, for example, an awful lot of our consumption in the United States is in military hardware and military activities, which we have very little control over individually. But this is a choice we have to make nationally. This is where I think we've got to think in terms of really big, bold terms. Now, in terms of defense, for example, you know, we all get out and demonstrate against war. I think it's time to get out and demonstrate for a complete dismantling of the military establishment. Now, I would argue this is not a flaky peacenik idea. If you think about it in terms of serious military science, and I did my military service in the Air Force as a captain. I taught at the Special Air Warfare School, and I worked in the Pentagon. You know, the reality is, as a nation, we do not face any conventional military threat. And if you really understand military science, one of the things that is well understood, you know, our only enemies are what you call unconventional, and using conventional military force against unconventional enemies is counterproductive. It only creates more unconventional enemies. So we have no reason to maintain our military establishment, so we need to get rid of it. And that'll save a lot of consumption. Now, you begin to think about other ways in which energy and materials are wasted. You know, so much of our auto-dependent society, it's not just a matter of a lack of public transit, but it's the way we have distributed ourselves so that we're totally disconnected from between our work and our shopping and our school and all the various aspects of our lives. So we need to be organizing into more compact communities so most of us can walk to work and walk to school. You know, we need smaller homes and more multifamily dwellings, which, I mean, some huge portion of our energy goes into heating and maintenance of buildings, and the potential to reduce that. But, you know, this is not a small agenda. This is about a total shift in how we think about space and how we spread ourselves out over the earth and the way we live and, you know, having homes with more common facilities and common walls and so forth. But it is time, absolutely, for big, bold ideas. There's no other way we're going to get down to an 80% reduction in energy and other consumption and deal with the issues of equity.
You know, David, I was struck this week in what you were just saying about the defense establishment, that the Secretary of Defense, Gates, was complaining that the Air Force generals weren't listening to him. You know, it's just like the whole system is unraveling out there.
Yeah.
The other thing that you said earlier that I just want to bring us back to a little bit, and Eric's comment made me think about it, was when we look at our youth today, their technologies in communications, like you talked about, I think there's something like 40 or 50 million people have MyFace type website. MyFace, sorry. But it's like our generation, the elders here, we have resources, we have time, we have wisdom in many ways. We need to be meeting the young people on this planet now and saying, show us your ideas. Let us together implement those ideas, because that's part of the way I think that we're going to solve the problems of the future. I would just like to share how much I am in awe of this conversation that the two of you just had, how much appreciative I am of it. I know that for both of these speakers, just sitting here and having a conversation was a lot more of a daunting experience than coming up and doing a PowerPoint presentation. You guys were fabulous. Thank you. We have a couple of more things that we would like to do. One of the things that is going to happen next is Joanna is going to read to us one of her favorite poems. Joanna.
You're going to take part in this. It is a litany, and it is a poem by Diane De Prima. And it is an expression, I offer it as an expression of
allowing our expression of our intention for the future ones. And the language, I hope, will not be too shocking, but I do feel that if we want life to go on, we have to involve all the chakras, the lower ones as well. So, if you will stand, and your part in this is expressing your determination and intention by saying, "May it continue."
May it continue.
Okay, here we go. Cacophony of small birds at dawn. Sticky monkey flowers on bare brown hills. Bitter taste of early miner's lettuce. Music on city streets in the summer nights. Kids laughing on roofs, on stoops, on the beach, in the snow. Triumphal shout of the newborn. Deep silence of great rain forests. Fine austerity of jungle peoples. Rolling fuck of great whales in turquoise ocean. Clumsy splash of pelican in smooth bays. Astonished human eyeball squinting through eons at astonished nebulae squinting back. Clean snow on the mountain. Fierce eyes. Clear light of the aged. Right of birth and of naming. Right of instruction. Rite of passage. Love in the morning. Love in the noon sun. Love in the evening among crickets. Long tails by fire, by window, in fog, in dust, on the mesa. Love in thick midnight. Fierce joy of old ones loving. The night music. Grunt of mating hippo, giraffe, foreplay of snow leopard, screeching of cats on the backyard fence. Without police. Without prisons. Without empire. In sisterhood. Through the wars to come. In brotherhood. Though the earth seem lost, through exile and silence, with cunning and love, as woman continues, as breath continues, as stars continue, we begin the work, the great transmutation, a new heaven and a new earth. May it continue.
Please sit down for 1 second. Having just come from Passover Seders, after hearing that, I want to say Dayenu. A couple of very quick announcements. One thing I think you'd be happy to know, that there's somewhere around 450 people here tonight. And so it's quite a tribute. Any of the people who are attending the workshop this weekend, and I have to wish we would have had twice as many seats, we found out that Joanna is just a little bit more popular than the Rolling Stones. We sold out in 4 hours. For the workshop. So here, the closing question that I'd like to ask of all of you is, we started off the session tonight with a question. You had a chance to talk to a neighbor about it. Having heard what David and Joanna spoke tonight, what would be your answer to that question? What do you think is the most important question that we should be asking ourselves today? Take a few minutes to answer the question when you feel you've reached some completion. Please walk out together. Come downstairs. There's tables outside for people interested in wanting to know more about our sponsors. There's cookies and juice downstairs. There's books to buy. There's CDs to buy. And there's a chance to get David and Joanna to sign your book and maybe ask them a quick question in the process. So please take a couple of minutes and answer that question. Thank you.